All right, today's topic is specifically, we're getting a lot of back feed here. Can you hear that? Or is that someone's phone? All right. Okay, today's topic is, in the simplest form, is simply Ezekiel 37:38, where we have the list of nations that are going to invade Israel, which is Rosh, Meshech, Tubal, and etc. But particularly, we want to focus on Rosh, because people want to know, is Russia in Bible prophecy? Is Rosh in Ezekiel 37 and 38, is that a reference to Russia? And I'm gonna answer this very clearly and concisely. I'm going to give some solid arguments for it, but I want to state right at the outset, so that you understand the force of the answer. Rosh is not equivalent to Russia. Rosh is the Scythian nation who lent its name to the nation of Russia. There is more than one Scythian nation. So we're going to get into that. Now, we're going to take up this question. Let's start by reading Ezekiel 38, verses 1 through 3. I'm going to read it in the New King James, and then I'm going to read it in the ESV. The New King James, we read, "Now the word of the Lord," this is verses 1 through 3, "Now the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, set your face against Gog of the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal, and prophesy against him." So I'm just going to do the first two verses. We read the similar thing in the ESV, except it doesn't say Gog of the land of Magog, chief of Rosh and Meshech. It says instead, Gog of the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech. So we got a short little phrase we're looking at here. And is this little phrase best translated, the prince of Rosh and Meshech? Or is it best translated, the chief prince of Meshech? So, do we have a phrase here, Rosh, that we can say this is Russia, or related to Russia, or are we dealing with something that has nothing to do with Russia?
I got a question there.
We need the mic if you're going to do a question. Yeah. Either that or just say it and I'll repeat it.
Okay. It's just that if I had a map to see where this is.
Oh, I'll get into that. We will get into that. Definitely. I won't have a map, but I can give you the details. So, okay. Now, I'm going to point out there's only two ways to answer any theological or doctrinal question that you're going to come to in the Bible. Only two ways. The first way is you can weigh names and reputations. Sadly, that's where most evangelicals are. They'll find two or three brothers over here who stand for point A, and they'll find the big heavyweights over here on point B, and that's how they're going to be weighing almost every question they ever face. The problem with doing this is you're only going to be right as often as those heavyweight names are right. And if those heavyweight names are wrong, you're going to be wrong. This is not the right way to approach a doctrinal question. You want to approach it by weighing arguments. That's the only way to be a truth follower. Otherwise, you're a follower of men. Darby one time said that not every man can build a good road, but every man can recognize a good road. And I think this is true. So your job, you do not need to be an expert witness in this matter to have the right answer to this question. The only thing you need to have is you need to be a good, candid juror who can weigh the expert testimony for a point and the expert testimony against it. That's all. There's a difference between an expert witness and a juror, and your job is a juror. So, let's go into this question. When we're looking at Ezekiel 38, 1 and 2, and we read, is it the prince of Rosh and Meshech, or is it the chief prince of Meshech? I'm going to tell you right now, there's only two. I've read a lot of books and papers and articles on this subject. There's only two arguments that are presented against the Rosh and Meshech that I've ever found. There's one that's grammatical, and there's one that's linguistic. The grammatical one says that Rosh is an adjective and not a noun. And so they say that this is chief prince of Meshech. Now, at face value, this sounds a legitimate consideration, right? If someone says this is an adjective, you should, and they're coming from a point of expertise, you should at least say, okay, I can consider that might be true. And the other thing that they have in this grammatical argument is they'll point out, they claim that Hebrew, whenever you have a list of nouns, always uses conjunctions between every noun. Now, I can give you the technical word for it if you want. The technical word for that is polysundetom, but you won't remember that. You probably can't even spell it, and that's fine. But
that's what we
want,
spelling.
Yep. But the issue is here. They're claiming that Rosh here cannot be Russia or Rosh as a nation or people because there isn't an and there. And there needs to be an and there. And then the second argument is linguistic. And I've read a lot of books that have argued against Rosh being a reference to Scythian peoples or Russian peoples. And basically their only argument on a linguistic point is they just scoff and mock and they say it's ridiculous. It's just a coincidence that Rosh sounds like Russia and looks like Russia. It's just pure coincidence. There's never a nation anywhere near modern Russia that ever bore the name of Rosh. And that's the beginning and the end of their argument. That's it. So those are the only two arguments out of dozens of stuff that I've read on the subject that have ever been presented against the identification of Rosh with Russia. Now here's what's going to be interesting. As I started investigating this, what I discovered is that men have motives for their opposition to Rosh being Russia. This isn't purely an academic matter where they weighed a mountain of evidence for and against and they said, you know what? I honestly think that the argument for Rosh being Russia is really weak and I'm not going to go there. They started with opposition to Rosh's Russia. The primary reason, when you look in all the literature on the subject, the primary reason men have rejected this, it's the underlying reason, is they've started with the theory of evolution. The theory of evolution says that all of the high societies, the advanced societies in the past history, were in the Mediterranean, in the Fertile Crescent, and there was no advanced societies in Europe or in Russia. There's none. There can't be. It's impossible. There was no advanced societies deep in Africa either. They start with that as an assumption. And so then you've got evangelicals and wishy-washy evangelicals that are influenced by this evolutionary approach to ancient history. And they look at the maps made by these people that are influenced by the evolutionary theory of the Middle East and the evolutionary theory of Europe. And they look at these evolutionary maps which have all these ancient peoples in the Middle East and none of them up in Europe or in Russia. And they say, wow, all the experts have all these nations right down here in Turkey, in the Middle East, and maybe up to the Caucasus Mountains, but they don't have any of them north of the Caucasus Mountains. None of them are north of the Black Sea. None of them are north of the Caspian Sea. Well, I guess my dispensational and fundamentalist Bible-believing friends are just got a loose screw. This is not true. amongst the people that are actually evangelicals, the primary reason they go racing after this rejection of Rosh is Russia is because they bought into the Muslim Antichrist theory. They're post-tribbers that think the church is going to go through the tribulation and we're going to face a Muslim Antichrist. And so they love these maps that have Meshech and Tubal and Rosh in Turkey. Now, when you come to these maps, I want you to think of these maps. These maps are not wrong. But these maps are partial truth. Okay, this is what we have to understand. There were colonies of Rosh and Gomer and Tubal and Meshech and all of the Sumerian and German and Scythian tribes all had colonies in Turkey.
All these are Scythian nations.
Scythian and German and Scandinavian.
Yeah, okay.
Yep. And so all these peoples came down and invaded from the north, just like they invaded later in history, and they invaded Rome, sacked Rome twice. These invading northern nations came down to Turkey and had colonies. Well, you see these scholars, they make a little map of the Middle East and they put all these nations there. The problem is, they insist that those colonies in Turkey are not colonies. That's the original homeland. This is a huge mistake. Nobody can take that ground unless they are either ignorantly ignorant of ancient history or they are intentionally and prejudicially ignorant of ancient history. Let me give you an example. It's not Rosh, but it's related. In the New Testament, we read of Galatia. Where was Galatia? Holler it out. Okay, but where was Gaul in the New Testament map?
The Franks
were the area of France. No, you've answering my second question, not my first one. Galatia in all the New Testament maps was in Turkey, right? Yeah. Okay. So, but the Romans spoke of three Gauls. There was a Gaul in Spain. There was a Gaul in Italy, and there was a Gaul in Turkey. But no Roman ever thought for a moment that was the end of Gaul. Because as you just brought out, Nathan, original Gaul is modern France. We talk about Gallic food, right? Where were the Gallic Wars fought? Well, the armies of Rome had to march north to modern France. It was a long march. Okay, so this is how this works. These nations literally did have colonies in Turkey, but that's not their homeland. So let's look at some of the objections now. Let's start with the argument that Rosh, grammatically speaking, can't be Russia. Or it can't be Rosh, which is a Scythian tribe that gave its name to Russia. First of all, I'm going to point out, in Ezekiel 38:2, in the Septuagint, the translation reads, the prince of Rosh, Masech, and Thabal, or Thobel. In other words, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. Now, does anyone here not raise your hand if you don't understand the significance of the Septuagint, and I will explain it for the whole audience. Okay, I see a hand. That's fine. The Septuagint is a translation of the Hebrew Old Testament by people who spoke and lived Hebrew. And they put it into Greek because most of the Hebrew-speaking and Jewish-speaking peoples and most of the Gentile proselytes to the Hebrew religion, spoke Greek. So when we have the Greek translation here, the Greek Septuagint, and they translate this by Rosh and not by chief, not by an adjective, this tells us that native Hebrew speakers, just a couple centuries after Ezekiel was written, native Hebrew speakers that also knew Greek thought this was Rosh and not an adjective like chief prince. The other thing that this tells us is, not just on the grammar, the other thing this tells us is that these Septuagint translators knew of a nation called Rosh. Otherwise, they wouldn't have put it there. Now, here's another point. There's another translation of the Old Testament scriptures into Greek that's called Theodotion. It's not the Septuagint. It's a completely independent, different Greek translation. There's a third one called Symmachus. We won't go there. But Theodotion, he also translates Rosh, the Hebrew word Rosh, as the nation Rosh. Here's the third argument on this that's associated with this. In, if you're writing down notes, Jeremiah 25, verses 23 through 26, we see that Jeremiah speaks of a Rosh that's in association with Dedan and Elam. Now, we heard earlier today that Elam was up in northwest Iran. It's right up there. It was kind of situated south of south and west of the Caspian Sea, so it'd be south and east of the Black Sea. And that nation there bordered right on Elam. Okay. So we know that there's a nation, an ancient nation, that bordered on Elam. It was north of Elam. But there's also now, here's something about Hebrew grammar. Remember I said that the Hebrew, these anti-Rosh people claim that we need to have an and in there in the Hebrew. If we don't have an and, then it can't be Rosh and Meshech. There's a problem with this argument. It's completely bogus. Hebrew regularly has links or a series of nouns, just like we in English have series of nouns and we just put commas between them. Excuse me. Hebrew doesn't use commas, but Hebrew would put a whole row of nouns. And I'll give you an example. Isaiah 66:19, there's a whole bunch of nations listed in a row and there's no commas in the Hebrew. There's no vavs, which is the Hebrew and. There's nothing there. It just says Tarshish, Pool, Lud, Tubal, Dedan. Just list them. There's no ands in between them. Here's another one. In Genesis 5:32, we read, Noah begat Shem, Ham, and Japheth. There's no and between Shem and Ham. Just an and between Ham and Japheth. Similar thing in Hebrews 11:26, we read, He begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran. There's an and between Nahor and Haran. There is not an and between Abram and Nahor. And there's more examples that you could give. The Hebrew Bible is full of these examples. So the entire argument on the grammatical basis that we have to have this mean the adjective chief instead of a nation, Rosh, because there's no and there, so we got to treat it like an adjective, it's completely false. The only way a Hebrew scholar could defend this argument here is either he's not really a Hebrew scholar or he's willing to ignore Hebrew scholarship, flush it down the potty for a prejudice. All right. The second thing I want to point out here is there is on the Hebrew grammar is the claim, this is also dealing with the fact they claim that this should be an adjective, right? So they're saying it's not chief, or not prince of Rosh, but prince chief of Meshech. There's a problem here. Two problems. If this is prince chief, which we would say chief prince in English, you have the adjective after the noun in Hebrew. If you study Hebrew, you know that's not the case. The adjectives follow, I mean precede the noun, similar to English. That's the general way it's done. Maybe someone that's a world-class Hebrew expert could go through Hebrew documentation and find an example or two where it's not true. We have one or two examples in English that are not true with rare adjectives. But as a general rule, adjectives in Hebrew precede the noun they qualify. They don't follow the noun they qualify. So that argument on that level is completely bogus. It can't be an adjective. But there's more here. Every translation in the whole world on this passage agrees that it is the chief of Meshech. So that they have a, you know what the genitive is, or the possessive, right? So that you have chief is the noun and the of phrase is of Meshech, the chief of Meshech or the prince of Meshech. So in Hebrew, there's a rule that they call non-intervention. What this means is if we have prince of Meshech, which everyone agrees that's what it is, you can't have anything come between those two. You can't have another adjective, you can't have another noun there, unless that other noun is also an of word. So if they have chief prince, which in Hebrew would be prince with the adjective chief, of Meshech, you have an impossible construction in Hebrew. You can go through a dozen Hebrew grammars, you will not find a single example anywhere. Every Hebrew grammarian will insist you cannot have anything that comes between a noun and the noun it's modifying. Nothing. It's just not possible. So here, this entire grammatical argument against Rosh, referring to a nation, has been exploded by actual Hebrew grammar and exploded by the translation of the Septuagint, exploded by the use of the Hebrew Bible itself. So let's move on to the information that we have. Yeah, bring the mic over to Henry, please.
Ron had it, I thought.
Yep.
The King James Version doesn't use Rosh.
Yeah, you're right, it doesn't.
That's right.
So yep.
The King James Version is, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech.
Yes.
And Tubal, and prophesy against him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so where is Rosh in that equation?
The word in the there in the you have in the King James where it says chief prince, the word chief would be Rosh. And they're translating it as an adjective. In the English, the chief precedes the word for ruler or prince. In the Hebrew text, that word actually follows.
So he's saying the chief prince is Rosh, or just the word chief?
Word
chief.
Yeah, they will. So.
Now say that again, Lee, what he just said.
His question was, which word is the one they're taking for Rosh? And I said it's the adjective chief.
Chief.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
So then, explain how that fits in here.
So if you had the King James, for instance, and you were reading it, let me pull that up here on my, here I'll just switch to the King James. Yep, and I would translate this in verse 2, I would say, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, and Meshech, and Tubal. That's how I would translate that. So, any questions here before we move on the grammatical stuff?
Of the land of Magog, then the prince of Rosh.
Yes.
That's the adjective of Magog?
Well, no. Some people translate it as that word Rosh is an adjective that means chief. Because see what you happen here. We have this word Rosh, And in Hebrew, it means head. And it can be used as an adjective that means chief or head. Like head master, head king, chief king, or whatever. But it's also a place name for a nation. So that's why there's this question raised, is this an adjective here or a nation? The word itself can be an adjective. But as we looked at the grammar, it's in the wrong place to be an adjective.
The word chief.
Yep.
That's what you're saying.
Yep. It's in the wrong place in the Hebrew to be an adjective. Which is why the bulk of people that take prophecy literally, historically, have, because of this Hebrew grammar, have gone in the direction of saying the translation that this is Rosh referring to a nation is correct. All right.
So, okay, real quick. So, how many other areas in Ezekiel can you find this? Obviously, it's right here.
Here.
Is that a relevant question?
Well, yeah, I'll just reiterate the question. The question is, does this information on Rosh appear anywhere else in the book of Ezekiel? It only appears in chapters 38 and 39 in reference to this whole invasion. Now, the nation is mentioned elsewhere in the Old Testament, but not in this kind of a connection. Yeah. Now the next argument, we've already exploded the grammatical argument, there's a linguistic argument. And the linguistic argument just laughs. They say, the linguistic argument simply is, it's just a coincidence that Rosh looks like Russia. And I can look at that and say, okay, I can understand that. This does happen. You can have a word in one language that looks really familiar to a word in another language, and they're completely unrelated. But here's the problem. We're talking similar words in Indo-European languages that are influenced in a part of the world where the Semitic languages and Indo-European languages were using similar names for nations and peoples, just like we do today. And this isn't like as if you accidentally had a word for house that sounded like someone else's word for mom in another language. This is two languages having the same name or similar name for the same people. So, let me point this out. In English, we say better, right? Does anyone know the German word for better? It's besser, right? German has an S, English has a T. But it's the same word. Okay. And we could give 100 examples like this. Greek has thuros, German has tour, English has door. It's the same word. The similarity is not accidental. The similarity is not coincidental. And you could multiply these examples to tens of thousands of words, nouns mostly, but also verbs, in Indo-European languages. We even have Hebrew words and Phoenician words in the English language that have been in the English language so long people don't even know they came from the Semitic languages. You ever heard the phrase shiver the timbers, like the pirates used to say? That phrase shiver the timbers goes back through the language of the nautical language and seaman's language all the way back to the Phoenicians and the Hebrews when they were sailing. Shiver is the Greek verb shaver, to break. And that shiver goes all the way that far back. So we have Rosh, and people say, well, Rosh, that's just superficially resembles Russia, right? Let me give you some arguments that this is not the case. Have you ever heard the word Roscosmos? Russian Space Agency. Roscosmos. How about Roshydromet? The Russia weather monitoring body. Rosatom, which is Russian Atomic Company. The list goes on. Russia itself uses Rosh. Here's another interesting one.
Can I say something? I took Russian 4 years.
Yeah.
You probably know that, you already know this, probably because you've watched, you've taken a look at the word for Russia in Russian.
Yep.
But it's R-R-O-C-C-E-Y-A.
Yep.
Russia, Ras.
Yep.
Which is, it's not Rus, it's not Russia, it's Russia, Russia. R-R-O-S, like Rosh.
Yeah.
Rosh. It's an O sound, it's not a U. We say Russia.
Yep.
But that's our corruption of that, or our we say, transliteration.
Yep. And what you're referring to is called, there's a vowel shift. And in every Indo-European language, that vowels shift to different languages. You have what they call, in the Semitic languages, they have what they call the Canaanite shift. So that, for instance, in Hebrew, we say Rosh. But in Arabic, it's Rasu. So it's Ras. In Aramaic, it's Res. In Ugaritic, it's Ris or Res. And in Akkadian, it's Res or Ros. So the vowels shifting from language to language. Now I want to point out something. These people say, okay, now that it's just a coincidence, and there is no nation ever had that. Well, there's some very fascinating things that I have discovered here. When you read ancient history, the ancient Greek historians, the ancient Latin historians, doesn't matter who you read, you will discover that there was a handful of Scythian nations, including Rosh and Magog and Tubal and a half a dozen other Scythian nations. And these people lived around the Black Sea. If you can picture in your map the Black Sea, which is over there by Turkey and Ukraine and Russia, and the Caspian Sea, which is over there towards Kazakhstan and Persia. Okay, in between these two seas and north of these two seas, north all the way to the Arctic Ocean, west all the way to the Baltic Sea, and east all the way to Mongolia and India was the Scythian peoples. One of the names for the Great Wall of China in Chinese is the Wall of Magog. That's how far these Scythian peoples spread. They were afraid of them. They're terrified of these people.
Name those boundaries again from where to where?
The Scythian peoples were on the north side of the Caucasus Mountains in between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. And from there they went north all the way to the Arctic Ocean, west all the way to the Baltic Sea. They were west, way over into the Ukraine, and they were east, past India, all the way to China. The Scythian peoples were a gigantic, powerful series of tribes. I don't know that anyone knows that, because from time immemorial, they were spread in the entire modern area of Russia and Ukraine, and all the way down to the Middle East.
I suggest that where they came from was that the confusion of the languages, when God came down and confused the languages and the peoples dispersed throughout the...
If you go that far back, yeah, there's right. No doubt, yeah.
You know,
I was just thinking of the question of where was their original homeland after the dispersion, and all we know for sure is that from time immemorial, they've been in the whole area of Russia from in Ukraine all the way east to India. That's they've been there for time immemorial. What's that?
Oriental?
No, they were light-skinned, blonde, red-haired, blue eyes, occasional green eyes, red beards. They were just like the Germans and the original Gauls and the Scandinavians. And they mingled depending upon where they were in the world. North of India, they mingled with the northern Aryan peoples. When they were in the north of Iran, they mingled with the early Persians, who were also Japhetic peoples. When they were in the Middle East, they mingled with whoever was there.
Ras is a word for red in some, red, which means red hair.
Yes, that is definitely an Eastern European root. Yes.
You got a word west.
You know.
Very good observation. But now I wanted to give you some information, because there's the claim that these peoples were not found anywhere in ancient history, anywhere near Russia. But the fact of the matter is, we find the place name for Rosh. Not only is it found three times in the Septuagint, once bordering on Elam. If it's bordering on Elam, it has to be north of Elam. We find it 10 times in Sargon's inscriptions. It's found once on Ashurbanipal's cylinder. It's found once in Sennacherib's annals. It's found 5 times on the Ugaritic tablets. A total of 20 references outside the Bible. And the ancient historians, as I mentioned before, always locate these people north of the Caucasus Mountains, north of the Black Sea, north of the Caspian Sea, covering Asia. So here this whole linguistic argument is exploded. There's the Rosh people in a half a dozen other Scythian tribes were in modern Russia. So there's a tremendous amount of information on the linguistic level, on the history level, and on the grammatic level, why Rosh is not just a legitimate translation, but really is, in my mind, the only translation. But that takes us back now. Is Rosh equivalent to Russia? Well, no, it's not equivalent to Russia. Rosh peoples were a very dominant Scythian tribe, and their name was lent to the modern nation of Russia. But when you take a name, the tribe of Tubal, which is also was a Scythian tribe, that has become the a city in Georgia. That name is found in Georgia, for instance, with the city Tbilisi. It's found in Russia with the name Tobolsk. And Rosh is found all over in place names in Russia. Tubal is found all over in place names in Russia, the Ukraine, and Georgia. Meshek is found all over. It's not just, Meshek isn't equivalent to Moscow. That's a superficial mistake to make. Meshek lent its name to Moscow. There's dozens of place names in those Scythian countries, Ukraine, Russia, Georgia, where the name Meshek has also been left. Every one of these tribes left their names there. So basically what Russia is, modern Russia, is all these Scythian tribes who intermingled with each other today so that they're not recognizable as individual tribes anymore, with a heavy influx of German and Scandinavian bloodlines. Because the Scythians would invade Germany and Scandinavia, the Scandinavians would invade Germany and Russia, and they mingled. They had a big collision basically in Ukraine into Western Russia. Mingled their bloodlines. So does anyone have any other questions or thoughts or observations on this whole question of Rush in Russia and Rosh?
What about Rush?
It's gotta be a Russian.
Russian.
Yeah.
Are you going somewhere now with this? You're going somewhere. It's finished.
I mean, unless, basically my conclusion is when we come to Ezekiel 38:2 here and in verse 3, that we should translate this, it's legitimate to translate it, that Rosh, it should be the prince of Rosh and Meshech, not chief prince of Meshech. And then the second thing is, I really do believe that Russia is going to be in prophecy in the future. Because when we have, in this chapter here in Ezekiel 38 and 39, you have this Gog, who's the head of Magog and Meshech and Rosh and Tubal and all these Scythian nations, they're going to gather together a massive, insane horde of countries. And
not just Russia.
And it's going to include Gomer, which is Germany, Togarma, which is the Scandinavian nations. It's going to include Persia. It's going to include Ethiopia. And it says there's a whole bunch of other nations there.
And
well, that's a different battle. Yep, that's later in the book of Revelation. But this here, all these nations are going to be gathered together. They're going to come against Israel. After the rapture of the church, prior to the beginning of the 70th week. And they're going to have this invasion. It's going to be a very dark hour for Israel. And God is going to judge these nations. This is why I'm looking forward. It's one of the next things we're going to see. In fact, we see it now. The stage being set. Russia is moving forwards at breakneck pace to build up her military might. She's way behind America. It won't stay there. Especially if we keep going in a Democratic Party direction.
It would seem like Russia and China would unite on that sect as well.
I don't think that they're capable of having a long-term unity or harmony. They're just way too different. Yep. I mean, they're united only in the sense that they're united against America, but they're not good bed partners.
Yeah, but how would that work out as Russia develops its power body, drawing in all these other nations? Where's China going
to... She'll be left out in the cold, doing her own thing, gathering all military might in Asia.
More than even
America. Yep. Did you have something you wanted to add to this, Henry?
No. I just wanted to know where you were taking
it. Yep.
The war, Ezekiel war, you put it post rapture, pre tribulation.
Yeah, absolutely. Some folks disagree where to put it. I just, to be honest, I can't see putting this prior to the rapture like some do, because in my mind, even though we see prophecy being fulfilled only in the sense of the stage being set for the last days, strictly speaking, I don't think a prophecy is going to be literally fulfilled until after the rapture of the church. The rapture is the first real prophecy.
So the reason why Russia and all those nations come down into Israel is they come down to theft, to steal, plunder, right?
That's right. The nations come down to Israel for her riches.
Russia's basically bankrupt right now.
Yep.
So where do you see Iran in that?
Persia. And I see, we even see growing connections strengthening by the year between Russia and Iran.
So you believe Persia is part of the...
Absolutely. In fact of the matter is, I believe Turkey is going to leave NATO in align with this whole thing. Turkey as a nation has a very interesting derivation. The name for the nation of Turkey comes from Togarma. Togarma is the utter parts of the north. The utter parts of the north is the Scandinavian nations. And those peoples came and invaded the Middle East. They came down. And Turkey gets its name from the Turkish peoples who were in southeastern area like Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan. And those Turks invaded Turkey many centuries ago and brought their language. You can prove by DNA that those Turkmenistan people are a mixture of the local regional peoples and the Scandinavian Scythian peoples. Those peoples invaded Turkey and gave their name to the nation of Turkey and to the language that they speak there, Turkish. But Turkey itself was the original melting pot nation. It was a mingling of all the peoples that were originally there, like the Hittite peoples, and a mixture of Scandinavian peoples, Germanic peoples, and the Scythian peoples. They all mingled into a big melting pot. So when you have all these nations that are mentioned here, Turkey's not mentioned specifically, but because she's made up of all the nations that are mentioned, I think those men that say Turkey is part of this invasion are correct. I think we're going to see Turkey and Russia and Iran aligned. But what's interesting, I think we're also going to see Germany there. I think we're going to see the EU collapse. And I think that we're going to see Germany, Gomer, drift east, align herself with Russia, and then the EU, is, as we see it, is going to be greatly weakened. They've already lost their number one economic might. Now they're going to lose their number two. And that brings us into a whole other question.
Number two, Germany.
Yes. It, that leaves us with a whole other question, which is really would be a completely different message for another time. But well, I could just give a few thoughts here. I think that what we're going to end up seeing is the Roman Empire that's going to rise in the last days is going to be comprised of the nations that were formerly and originally part of the Roman Empire. Germany was never part of the Roman Empire. The Rhine River was the border. France was part of the Roman Empire. Germany was not part of the Roman Empire. And that's going to be the heart of the Roman Empire along with her colonies. And so it's going to look very different. A lot of people tend to look at Europe as it is right now as the Roman Empire of the last days. But I think the map is going to be rearranged. And what's interesting about this, when I was a young Christian many, many years ago, I used to tell my friends, the Soviet Union has to collapse. And they'd say, well, why does it have to collapse? Because it's Russia in the last days, not the Soviet Union. And
It collapsed.
And I've been saying for 20 years that I don't, you know, I've read numerous books by people to say America's going to cease to exist, or we're going to be a second-rate nation, the dollar's going to collapse. Got a whole string of books I read on that whole subject. And I don't think America's going to collapse. I can't tell you whether we're the head of the Roman Empire or the tail of the Roman Empire, part of the Roman Empire, but I think we're colonies of the fractured Roman Empire. How would we not be part of the Roman Empire? The last three superpowers in the world prior to America were Spain and France and England. Western toes of the fractured Roman Empire. And control of Israel went back and forth between the eastern half of the Roman Empire and the western half. The eastern half had gotten swallowed up in Islam. This is why I think that the toes of iron and clay is Islam in Western Europe. They don't mix.
I think Cuba.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Cuba is going to wag the tail of the Roman Empire.
You could be right. Yeah. So anyways, I think we're going to see things rearrange. I think we're going to see Germany leave.
So,
go ahead, brother.
I'm throwing something out in left field.
Yeah, yeah.
The tremendous
rise in communism.
Yes.
Okay. And even right now.
Yes.
It's tentacles everywhere.
Yep.
And you have in communism a denial of God, by definition.
Yes.
The worship of the man leading it.
Yes.
So it's the worship of man.
Yep.
And a global communistic oneness.
Yep.
How do you see communism itself as a philosophy of government? I don't know whether you want to go to China or what, but...
Yep.
How do you see that
coming to pass in the last days?
Coming to pass or being part of
yep.
that last philosophy of Gentile government that takes over the world?
Yep. Well, we can deal with the Islam question next, but let's deal with this Marxist question first. The original idea of Marxism was not to give the whole world communism. If you think about the Marxist dialectical thinking, you have a thesis and antithesis, and you're aiming for the synthesis. And so they were opposing communism to democracy. And their end game was never to fill the whole world with communism. Their end game was for these two things to come together and have socialistic democracies where people through democracy vote themselves socialistic powers, because people under that form don't realize that they're socialistic, and they brought it on themselves and they vote themselves all kinds of pork barrel benefits. So we thought that we finally won the war against communism when Russia fell, right? The Soviet Union collapsed? Oh no, that was part of the plan all along, was to spread the Marxist message to the entire world. America has slowly been turning herself into a socialistic state. We didn't win that war. We thought we won the Cold War, and we didn't. We got our butts kicked. We're becoming a socialistic nation. And Russia still is where they originally aimed to go, with the synthesis, with a democracy that votes itself the same things that they tried to get by gunpoint in socialism. So where I'm going with this, Henry's right. When we get to this final form in the world, it's going to be atheism. The God of the Bible is going to be rejected. And when they worship a man, they're worshiping an exalted man. Terrible. Now, we only got just a couple minutes, so I'm just going to barely touch on this Islam question. I just want to touch on it in this one way, is that some people today, it's very growing popular theory that the Antichrist is going to be Islamic, and Islam is going to be the one world religion. I cannot go there. And the reason I cannot go there is it says very clearly in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 that the Antichrist is going to exalt himself against all that is called God or reverenced or worshipped. You can't go, you can't have a Catholic Antichrist or an Islamic Antichrist. The Antichrist, what we see in the middle of the 70th week is the woman that rides the beast is burned by fire in the middle of the 70th week. The Antichrist is going to set aside Babylonian religion as we've known it, regardless of what kind. Hinduism, Buddhism, the one world whore religion, it's all going to get set aside. And the only religion on the planet is going to be the worship of the Antichrist and the worship of the devil. But with this, we're going to have to close so we can take a quick break here.